It's January 26th, 2012. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fine living, advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery.
Our new privacy policy takes effect March 3rd.
Indeed. Stay tuned.
We should put a privacy policy up.
Yeah, well, we are unifying the privacy policy across all of the Hell Yeah member sites and services.
Whether we want to or not.
Yes, you no longer have to deal with all of those different individual Hell Yeah privacy policies. Yeah. We are referencing the new Google Terms of Service and Privacy Policy, which we're going to talk about later in the show. Before we get to that, though, we've got our stuff. So, Emery, what's been on your mind this past week?
I have been going all like Johnny Detective on some tech spam that I've been getting.
And this is the kind of thing you would do. Like, you would not rest until those tech spammers are have been caught.
I am actually like considering filing multiple small claims cases against the individual that's doing it.
Yeah, right on, right on.
Well, here's the thing. And I would like to hear from people about this if I'm just taking this way too far. But here's the deal. A few weeks ago, and I'll actually tell you my hypothesis as to what happened. While I was on vacation in New England, I got a series of messages that were like some sort of trivia spam thing. And they said, you know, I got three messages right in a row. And they said, you know, thank you for signing up. We're only charging you $9.99 a month, and we will send you these ridiculous trivia questions periodically. You know, how many platypuses does it take to build a dam? And, you know, something really ridiculous. And I was just like, you know, you got to be kidding me. So I text back with stop, right? Because you're supposed to do that.
Yep.
And then I would get a message that says, you know, either I would get nothing back. And then one other time, I think I got a message saying, you know, you've been removed. And then there's also like this 800 number. It's not 800, but there's a toll-free number that you can call for customer support. Uh-huh. So I called them a couple times. And it's actually an answering service somewhere in Southeast Asia. I'm going to guess it's like the Philippines, but I'm not sure about that. And they say that they're in Canada. So I think the company that hires them is headquartered in Canada, but they're taking the calls in somewhere in the Philippines, I think.
That is bizarre and just a bit shady. Yeah.
The company sending me the text messages and trying to charge me $10 a month. And by the way, four different times. So on my bill, I have four different charges for $10.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah, yeah. From the messages that I said stop, I have already been billed like on my last statement. I think it was, it's 10 times each, four times.
Wow.
And I have, you know, I told them to cancel. I talked to the customer service people, told them to cancel. I mean, gosh, what else? There was, I want to say, in the span of like, you know, a week, all this happened. So what I wound up doing was tracking down the company, and they're headquartered in Boston. And as far as I can...
So it's a U.S.-based company? That seems...
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, here's the thing. That U.S.-based company is actually one dude.
Okay, yeah.
It's actually one person with a series of domain name registrations and two addresses in the Boston area. There's a profile of them on the Better Business Bureau's website, and it's like F-F-F-F-F-F-F-F. But here's the spooky part. So... And I'll get to how I can address this later, I guess, right? Like, should I talk about the, yeah. So I'll talk about blocking text charges later. But the short version here is my hypothesis on how this is happening is when we were in Boston, we stayed at a hotel in Cambridge. Uh-huh. That hotel had a hospitality wireless internet service. To use that service, you have to have a rewards program membership thing, and it's free to do it. So you just fill out this profile, but the form you fill out. And while I was doing it, I'm looking at this and I knew that it wasn't safe.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't occur to me what was going to be happening next.
Wait, I mean, was this a chain hotel or is this just like a?
It's random... a chain hotel.
Huh. Wow. Okay.
And so their hospitality wireless is it's an open wireless, and then when you get on, there's a captive portal thing. So like you can connect to the network, which is like hotel net, and then you try to go to a web page or whatever, and then you'll get you get Kanye'd, where it's like, I see you going to Google and I'm going to let you finish, but I want to tell you about my hotel chain. Where you got to sign up for this account and you got to go through all this stuff. And then you fill out this little profile to get a username and a password that you can then use to get on the wireless through their captive portal.
Uh-huh.
So in filling out this registration, one of the things they ask you for is your phone number. It's not the hotel, but since the wireless is open, essentially, it's not encrypted. You have to have a username and a password to get past the captive portal, but anybody within line of sight or within range of the wireless network can monitor everything on that network. And their sign-up form isn't encrypted. So what has happened, I am 90% certain, is that somebody monitors that network or all of the neighboring, because it's in Cambridge, yeah. And it's like in the middle of MIT and Harvard. There's a ton of hotels everywhere. And it's my belief that there is someone who camps that section of town and just harvests phone numbers and then puts them into their service.
It seems like there'd be easier ways to get lists of cell phone numbers, though. Don't you think?
This is the only time I have sent that phone number. I usually get people my Google Voice number.
Right, yeah.
This time, for whatever reason, I think it was because I didn't know if they were going to try to join it to the reservation.
Okay,
or something. I gave my actual cell phone number. And then the very next day is when it started.
Oh, wow. Huh.
So there's a correlation there that I'm not willing to let go of. Right. And in the course of looking at the wireless network when I got to the hotel, I could see that it was easy to do.
Yeah, no, it's
just, because it's one of those things where it's talking to my wife or people in my family, that HTTPS thing is important, right? Like, especially, and to not use open wireless. Like, I tell my wife all the time, when she's at the coffee shop, to never get on open wireless.
Right, yeah.
If she has to send an email or something to close down other applications and to bring up the email client, hop on, send your email, and get back off.
Yep.
Because all of her email stuff goes over SSL, like her home accounts, at school and everything is all protected that way. But
there are plenty of other things on her computer that don't communicate securely, I guess.
Correct. And then there's also, the thing is a lot of times you don't even know.
Yeah.
Or the assumption should be that they've already got a cookie set. And so if they have not done the due diligence to set their cookie privacy correctly, if you've already got an authenticated or logged in session with an application somewhere on the internet, there's a pretty good chance. Did you remember a year ago, that whole Fire Sheep thing? Someone released a Firefox plugin that would do this for you. It's exactly the same thing where it's like a sidejack. It's a side channel hijacking attack.
They steal your current session, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So even if they don't get your password because that was sent over HTTPS, they can still take your session cookie and use that to impersonate you.
It was actually, at Stanford, that all of the dorm and campus wireless networks are actually open as well.
Mm-hmm.
They use, they filter based on the computers that are on it. They don't give internet access to people who don't have authenticated computers. But among those computers, it's completely open.
Yep.
During the Fire Sheep thing, I remember there were some pranksters who were
I'm sure
who were messing with people's Facebook accounts. Because you could if you're on the same wireless network and the wireless network is open, it's not that hard. To hijack someone's Facebook account, while they're logged in. If they log out, then you're not. It's not like you've got their username and password.
But most people don't log out. They close their browser or they shut the lid and they just walk away.
Yeah.
And then that session data is that session cookie is valid for as long as it's valid, unless it expires or they terminate it.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
So, anyways, I am almost certain that my scenario is pretty close to reality. I've talked to somebody at the hotel chain. On their IT side,
uh-huh.
I talked to the manager of that particular hotel.
Did they take you seriously?
The
IT guy?
Yeah. The IT gal. She absolutely, she was a little fuzzy on like the vulnerability,
uh-huh.
and like wasn't quite necessarily aware of the attack. But once I explained it to her, like, she was on the up and up. Like, she knew that I wasn't, like, you know, trying to pull an over on her. I'm like, I still have to send her some information. But
yeah.
I've also contacted somebody who does, like, investigation work in Boston that I know. It's like just someone I've known for a long time, and that's kind of what they do. So there's a possibility, though, that I might just, like, file a couple of suits and in small claims court and then try to collect judgments on them.
Wow. That'd be cool to follow. Yeah.
I want this asshole's boat. Like, I'm just throwing it out there, but if it's happening to me, I am certain that it's happening to a lot more people. And if my hypothesis is correct, then they're harvesting them from a lot of folks.
Yeah.
So, if you have recently stayed in a hotel and used Open Wireless in the Cambridge area, I would like to hear if you've got a similar experience there. But that's not even like the worst of my problems, because then I'm talking to these idiots in call center somewhere and researching like this company and trying to find out where they are and who they are. And I think over the course of like since last summer, they've been trying to change all of their Whois information on all their domains to be private registrations. But through the magic of cached records in Google, cached pages in Google and other search engines, I've been able to like piece together kind of like and stitch a history of what these DNS records have said and what the registration information has been. So I've got a pretty good idea the parties involved, but I'm not 100% on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, have you thought about, instead of, you know, taking the case directly to them in small claims court or something.
Maybe
you know,
just burning their house down. Yeah, I thought about that too.
No, I was like, you know,
I signed them up for their own service. I took the phone numbers on their DNS registrations and signed them up for the same sites.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, because the phone number listed for the contact information on their domain names was I pulled the what's called the 1,000 number block. It's like the when phone numbers get allocated, they're being allocated in these blocks of 1,000. And this one was a Verizon Wireless block, so I figure it's either a cell phone or a prepaid cell phone from Verizon.
I
input it like multiple times into all of their sites. So yeah.
I was suggesting, like, you know, take all of the documents that you've collected, all this stuff, and you know, send them to a regulatory body that would care about them.
Well, that's just it. Like, I don't know if anyone does. Like, I don't have any corroboration, first of all, that they're doing what I think they're doing. And secondly, I don't see any reason to believe that the whole... I don't know what the numbers are. So I don't know at what point, like, a state's attorney general is going to give a rip.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know what tree I should bark up on that, but I do know that I want to get my licks in before I do that.
All right.
I am absolutely furious.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying very hard. Like, I sound like I'm, you know, I'm joking. I'm so pissed about this.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm completely butthurt over the entire experience, but not the least of my problems is that lately hard drives everywhere I go are dying. I have had...
You described, I forget if it was last week, the week before, you described you had several drives fail.
Well, let me tell you, Alan, I had a 500 gig drive that died like a year and a half ago that I never sent in for RMA. I sent that one in and got one back. That was fine.
Yep.
I had a 1 terabyte drive that flaked out and died. I sent it back. They sent me a new one that lasted 24 hours and then it died.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
It was a brand new disc. And then they sent me another one that was a certified repaired unit that apparently has had to clear like 3 different diagnostic tests before it leaves the warehouse. It didn't make it 8 hours.
Wow.
Talk to them today. They're going to be sending me another one. And then in my NAS, I had another one of the same drives, these 1 terabyte Seagates.
Yeah.
I can give you
not a new one, right? I mean, this one's been in there for a while.
No, this one's been there for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
But there's one and then maybe two in that array that are starting to flake. Huh. But it was bad enough that, like, if I would try to access one file in particular, there's like a 200 meg file, and if I tried to open it, like the whole NAS would just crap its pants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it would actually freeze. Like it was causing a kernel panic. It was that bad. And I'm like, well, that's not good. Like, you know, I'm looking down at the front of it, and I'm like, I don't see any error messages or anything, but it would like hard block.
No, the symptoms of hard drives dying are some of the just scariest symptoms.
Sometimes you'll hear a noise, sometimes you won't.
Yeah.
And then this one like doesn't have any smart failures reported, but when I ran the tools this morning at my office, I took it in to use the forensics workstation just to pull some stuff off if I could. But this is great. I plug it in and the vendor's tools CD boots and it's like, you know, welcome to tools, blah, blah, blah. And it's doing its check and it's like, there are no smart failures reported. You know, do you want to do the basic test or the advanced test? And I click on basic and it goes, there are too many bad sectors for me to complete the start the test.
Like, this is not even a hard drive anymore.
And then the
you've
one
inserted
that,
pastrami in this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's now a ham sandwich hooked up to the SATA cable. Please remove the ham sandwich and try again.
Yeah.
There was another the one that they sent me that was recertified does not even show up on the SATA bus anymore. And I thought, my concern was like, holy crap, like, do I have like a bad SATA controller? Is my cabling bad? Are these like, but I was brave and I took another disk in that machine and I swapped controllers and cables and it's been fine.
Huh.
So I know that these drives are failing. And so that's, what is it? We're up to five hard drives in less than a month.
Wow.
And then yesterday, the POS Dell Attitude laptop on my desk at work that I run Fedora on, that hard drive failed. And that laptop is like just under 2 years old. No, it's about 2 years old.
And it's amazing because you are probably the most fastidious person about data redundancy that I know. I mean, like, you're on top of this stuff.
Yeah. I have... Like, I don't even care. Like that's just it. Is that I have all these disks that are like failing and everything, and everyone's like looking at me like, first of all, what is wrong with you? And I must have like, you know, like in the video game BioShock, I think it's possible that there's like something like wrong with me at a cellular level that I might be like in danger of becoming a superhero in a comic book or something. Like, I don't even. But the short version of this is that the IT guys at the office have taken my laptop and they don't know what's going on with it, but it failed smart and it's like spewing errors all over the place. But that laptop was with me. I usually don't take it anywhere, but I had it with me for a couple days last week. And so I'm a little spooked.
Yep.
But yeah, I've got, you know,
you've got that static touch.
But I have like, everything's good. Like, I haven't lost anything.
Have you been like carrying around super magnets with you lately or something?
You know what? Now that you mention it, I have been walking around with a super magnet, whatever the hell that is. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's my pocket degausser.
Yeah. Oh, man. And then on top of this, I'm told that not only were your hard drives getting sick, but you were.
I felt like I was going to die. Yeah. Someday. Like Saturday, I moved my home office from upstairs to the basement. So we're cleaning out or rearranging some stuff in the house. So I had like lugged all my desk and I should back up a little bit. I exaggerate when I say my desk. My desk is actually a door on sawhorses from when I worked at an office in Providence when they put in new doors that had like glass windows so people would stop walking into people. they had all these like giant wooden doors and one of the facilities guys, I was like, hey, what are you guys doing with all these doors? And he's like, burning them. So I was like, okay, do you mind if I take one? So I've got this big giant desk, which is awesome because it's good for when I need to haul a computer out and open it up. It's good bench space.
Yeah.
And it's not fancy by any stretch of the imagination. But yeah, but so I felt miserable that night. And I thought it was because I was doing all this moving and everything. And then like at around 8 o'clock, I feel really like fuzzy in my head, like you know, Tom Hanks's brain cloud in Joe versus the Volcano, where he's like, it's got a brain cloud. And I went upstairs and my special lady was like, I don't feel good. Like, I've got a fever and my head's all fuzzy. And I'm like, we've got something. Like, there's something wrong with it. And she had a flu shot this year, but I didn't. So we don't really know what it was. We had just both been diagnosed with sinus infections earlier that week. But that night, I woke up. I had a hard time falling asleep. And then I woke up at like 4 in the morning because of a headache. Like my whole body hurt. Yep. And my head was just pounding and raging. It was so bad that like I was like stumbling my way into the bathroom trying to find like a Tylenol or something, and I saw an old bottle of Vicodin from like, you know, oral surgery I had like, you know, 3 years ago or whatever, and I took half of a Vicodin before I went back to bed. I was just like, this is absolutely out of control. And it's got like, I mean, those are acetaminophen, like 500 milligrams of acetaminophen and whatever else, but that was pretty serious. Lots of fluids. Never work on sick days. It's not a good idea. Yes.
Oh dear.
I didn't go to work, but I worked from home, and it wasn't pleasant. And then I got to watch a lot of Hoarders and Storage Wars,
which we're going to talk about later in the show.
Yeah.
Storage Wars being the best worst show on television.
Yeah, I was. I've had a pretty busy week.
All right. My week has been not busy, but not as eventful. Got two related things to talk about. Mm-hmm. So the first, which kind of leads into the second, is the Kindle Lighted Cover. I've had this $79. So I've got like the cheap Kindle, right? Which is great. It's fantastic. It's like the simple, dumbed down. It's $79 with ads, and I have the one without ads. So it's $109, oh, okay. I think. Yeah. And it's a super small Kindle, fits in my back pocket. It's great. But as with any Kindle, except the Kindle Fire, can't read it at night. And you know, or under low light, because the screen is not illuminated. So they sell this Kindle Lighted Cover, which is actually pretty nifty. It's leather, and it has these contacts that it slips over the Kindle really snugly. The Kindle is designed to accommodate this case, basically. And so it slips over the Kindle really snugly, and it's got these two contacts on the back of the Kindle that connected two contacts in the case, which then provide a battery power for the light. So you don't actually have to. The case doesn't take separate batteries. You don't need to charge it separately. None of that stuff. It just feeds off the Kindle's battery. And typically, it's an LED light, so it's super power efficient. It doesn't have to be that bright because it's just illuminating the screen. And so its power usage is great. Not too bad. It fits really snugly on the Kindle. Works great. Really, really recommended. The only problem is that this case is $60. Yeah.
How much do smart covers cost?
Is there a Kindle smart cover now too?
No. Oh. They just like the regular iPad 2 smart cover. Those aren't
iPad
cheap.
iPad 2 smart cover. No, I mean, I believe like when I bought an iPad case for the original iPad, it was expensive. It was like, $40 or something. Looks like that's still about what it is. Smart cover for iPad 2 is $40.
I'm not familiar with the Kindle Lighted Cover, but I wouldn't sweat $60 on a case. I have purchased like my favorite phone cases are from Vaja or Vaja, like VAJA, and some of those cases I've bought have been $200.
I don't so much mind the $60 for what is a very high quality case and it still fits in my back pocket with the case on, which is great. It looks great. It feels great. The lighting is perfect. The only issue I have with it is like the device itself is $110. So that a case that is more than half the cost of the device seems a bit excessive, and seems like, if you're looking at the target audience of like, you know, this is the low end Kindle, that seems like a pretty steep additional tack on to get a case that, it's the only case out there that I know of that integrates really tightly with the Kindle, because it's got it fits it really snugly, and it's got the lighting, the battery leeching prongs. So,
you and John were talking about protecting your Kindles in your bags, and I was always wondering, like, you know, do you really need to? Because I've just been throwing my iPad in my bag. I mean, I have like a screen protector on the front of it, but that's it.
Yeah, no, I typically, like previously, would just throw my Kindle in my bag, and there isn't really a big problem with that. In fact, I've actually got a separate pocket that it fits pretty well in. It's more actually the lighting. I was, as you know, because I was late for the show today because I spaced out, was walking around outside, just, you know, in the dark, mostly. I mean, you know, it was
looking through windows.
walking around outside in the dark and had my Kindle out with the, you know, with the LED light popped up, and it's just great. It's so nice to read under that light. So
do you think they should consider making, like, I mean, like the e-ink? I mean, my theory is that they still want to do like a hybrid display at some point, but do you think there's a good way to do like a backlight on that? Or
I guess
if there was, they would already,
yeah,
right?
I mean, because, like, of the nature of e-ink, it's you know, it's just not conducive to it. I mean, you could potentially, like, maybe illuminate the you know, like the white space, but that would suck, you know, like to have the part that you're reading be the part that's not illuminated, you know, the actual, like, letters be not illuminated. That would be terrible. So I mean, you know, that's basically looking at a normal screen, but potentially worse. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the nature of an e-ink display means that you basically have to light it from the top down.
Got it.
Like you would paper. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, top-down light is actually much nicer on the eyes than light that's coming right at your face. So I actually like it a lot. And I mean, I think this case is as close as you know, you could get to a really low-profile but very effective lighting solution. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't require its own power. It's, you know, it really does. I mean, the fact that the Kindle can still fit in my back pocket with this case on it, it, you know, means that, I mean, basically the case does not add, it adds a bit of weight. But that's actually, I mean, that device is so light that a bit of weight is actually a good thing. So,
It's not going to be a big problem, I don't think.
Yeah. Anyway, and then the reason that I was walking around after dark with my Kindle is because I am currently making my way through a Game of Thrones, the book series. I've not seen any of the TV series, and there's apparently a video game out now too. I'm
Game of
my
Thrones, the game
book series. Exactly. Game of Thrones. anyway, and it's good so far. It's you know, it's an intriguing fantasy setting, and I know you like your trashy fantasy. So
that's true, I do.
Anyway, it's been good so far, and I really enjoy reading on the Kindle. Kindle just stays in my bag all the time. I take it out to charge it once in a while, but it doesn't even need that often. And I mean, I've started walking more, and you know, because I can use that time, you know, whenever I'm walking, I just pull out the Kindle and read it while I walk. That's fantastic. It's really good stuff. So anyway, moving on, we have some news, as happens typically in the technology world. Yeah. News is generated. Netflix, the company that has become a roller coaster ride of a company as of late, is back up on the top of the hill. We've got
we're number one.
Some actually rather good news on the Netflix front.
Good for them.
Yeah. So they released their Q4 earnings report, and it includes 610,000 new U.S. subscribers, which is a good thing because last quarter they lost subscribers. They had the whole Quickster debacle.
How many subscribers, though, did they lose?
More than 610,000. So they're not quite even yet. They're now back up to 24.4 million. And I think before the whole Quickster thing, I think they were a little over 25 million. But I'm not exactly sure, but I did read that they are not yet back up to the pre-Quickster level.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. You know, like, there's something to be said for not having that many customers when you can lower your operating costs that much.
Yeah. So I also, in the earnings report, it's very clear. I mean, the new customers are coming from streaming. You know, it's not, they're not, I think they may have even lost customers in mail subscriptions. So it's very much streaming is the source of their new customers, which is also a good thing, right? The fact that if their growth is coming from the streaming side of things, then they've got even more an even stronger argument for keeping the focus on that.
Their intelligence has been correct, that they don't need to be in the mail business.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, I mean, there's this funny game where it seems like, you know, so Netflix was, they had the little Quixtra thing, they lost subscribers, their stock was down around $70. And it was story after story of analysts saying, yeah, you know, like, our new price target is $70. You know, Netflix is not going back up. And then this happens, and it's like, immediately, you know, our new price target is $120. You
know? Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think this is going to continue long term? Like, can they keep up this sort of growth?
Well, I think a lot of people probably quit just temporarily. Like, there's like a protest quit. No, I'm serious.
And, like, and then it's like, oh wait, I really did need that. That was
or they never intended to stay gone forever. Right, or they went and they tried something else. Like they tried another service. Hulu, like they went to Prime or they went to Hulu. You know, they checked something else out. They took that time to do that. They started doing more Apple TV rentals or whatever. Like you know, any number of things. And then they came back.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I don't think that they've, I mean, 610,000 new subscribers. I think, like, at least, you know, I don't see more than 25% of those being actually new subscribers. I think they're people that were using the service before. So, I mean, that's a good thing, though. That means that a lot of the people that quit are coming back. So that means that's going to reinforce Netflix's decision and kind of say, like, you know, maybe their initial reaction was really strong, but, you know, we really are delivering a better service.
Right. Yeah. Yep. And I mean, and another piece of news that came out of this. So during the Quixtra thing, part of what they said with Quixtra was, in addition to movies, we're also going to be renting video games.
What happened with that?
Yeah, so then the whole Quixtra thing died, and it was still up in the air as to whether maybe, you know, Netflix itself would start renting video games. As part of this announcement, basically those plans have been scrapped. So as far as people can tell now, and they, you know, did address it in the announcement, they do not have plans to rent video games in the near future. So
you know what they should do?
What?
I want Netflix to buy OnLive.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
because then they could stream video games.
Yeah, GameFly bought a streaming video game service. I forget which one, but yeah,
that's going to be a kind of a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. I saw a really good example of that type of technology. Not OnLive itself, but there was a. I forget where it was. I was on it may have been Orange.com, you know, the new EA service.
People that don't know, I mean, there's a couple of services out there now where you can effectively rent video games and then play them in like a virtual, like in a browser session. So you can like, you know, if you want to go play, you know, Quake or something, just for example, you log into the service and then you can rent the game for a fee and then you can play it remotely. And they have like a browser plugin that kicks the game back to whatever session you're on.
Yep, yep. And this was crazy. I was on the website for Origin. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, but they also have like the consoles. So you can buy like a physical hardware unit that you can plug into your television. And then you can have the experience of playing like on a video game console system like your PlayStation or a Wii, but you're streaming all of the content from a remote data center.
Yep, so, and I actually have one of the OnLive consoles. Got it free at PAX, cool. Video game convention I went to. Yeah, they were handing them out for free because they wanted people to use their service.
Huh.
Anyway,
what about Origin?
Yeah. So I was on Origin.com and I was looking at Dragon Age 2 and you could actually play the demo for Dragon Age 2 in your browser, which seems like a fantastic idea. I mean, that is a great use of this technology, because even if people aren't quite ready to play full games using this, the idea of just quickly in your browser being able to demo a game.
Yeah, and that's like the worst part about like video game websites too, is like watching some idiot like drone on, like, because every day if you go to like, you know, I don't know,
IGN, like,
and you got to sit through like a 30-second to 1-minute commercial, mm-hmm. and then you got to listen to like some completely hyper caffeinated basement dweller talk about all the wonderful features of this video game. Like, you got to trek here and you fight the dragons and then you got, yeah, it's absolutely out of control. So what are you going to do to that is, like, the whole concept of, like, just letting people do their own, like, little exploration, I think, is a huge win. Like, I would much rather just kind of click around and get a feel for it myself.
Yep, yep. So buying a service like this, a service that does streaming video games, could make sense for Netflix, especially given their whole shift towards online streaming of video content. I think that the main blocker here is it seems like at least Netflix leadership is very much focused on movies and TV. Like, that's kind of, like, they don't even really get video games. You know, their corporate culture is so structured around movies and TV that I think that's, like, it would be difficult for them to broaden into the more general case of, like, media content. But I guess they did bridge the gap to TV shows. Like, because they used to, you know, it used to be Netflix is equals movies, you know.
The OnLive people look to be also now doing, like, Windows desktop virtualization in the cloud.
Wow.
So, like, through your iPad, they will provide you with a 2 gigs of storage and a Windows 7 instance with Microsoft Office.
Wow.
So this is interesting too, because we should talk about this on a future show, because I think this is the same direction that Apple's headed in. And I have a lot of clues that this is kind of like their strategy going forward. I think in the future, like, the devices that they sell might just be like iOS devices that are able to connect to, like, infrastructure like that to do heavier computing.
Wow, that would be very interesting.
Yeah.
I do wonder if Netflix could expand into that sort of capacity.
I think they absolutely could. I mean, Netflix is running on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they like, their service runs out of EC2 and S3, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, like, they're already pretty nimble. I mean, Amazon is just killing in that business.
Yeah.
They just released, like, a new service this week with, what is it, like, a secure storage gateway thing. So for, like, $120 a month or whatever, you get, like, an encrypted portal into your data, something like that. I didn't read the whole thing about it, but they keep adding new features to AWS all the time.
Yep.
Yeah. And they're all good. Like, and, like, I haven't seen, like, a single dumb or bad service on there. I think Netflix could easily get into this business if they want to on their own, but I think they'd be better served investing in someone like OnLive or another company.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Cool. And the other big news this week is, as we alluded to at the beginning of the show, Google is unifying its terms of service and privacy policies across their services.
Yeah.
So there is now one Google privacy policy, one Google terms of service, which is it. There's a link in the show notes, google.com/policies. It's pretty, it's interesting because this, it's very readable. This unified terms of service and privacy policy is probably the most readable terms of service and privacy policy I've seen. It took me all of, like, 5 minutes to read through both of them this morning.
I like that they simplify it. I don't like that they have integrated all of their services.
Right. Yeah. So you were giving the example before the show of, like, an Android device that you've got to sign up for a Google account there.
So if you are a user of an Android phone and you have to have a Google account to activate and use that handset, you're essentially compelled to participate in this ecosystem of theirs, and you don't really have a choice. And everything that you do on your handset and, like, people that you talk to and things like that, that can influence, you know, the way things are presented to you at all Google properties. And on the one hand, like, I'm really not pleased with that. Like, do you think that this is, like, something that people I'm a little tweaked by this. Like, I don't know what to make of it yet. And I still, like, the Google has so much information on everybody and they have so many services. I don't know that this is where they should be headed.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the difference I can see is, like, previously you know, say you objected to something in the, let's say, the Google Docs terms of service, or the Google Docs privacy policy, and you really objected to this one thing, you could avoid having to agree to that thing by simply not using Google Docs.
Yes.
But in this case, if you object to something in the Unified Terms of Service or privacy policy, you have to basically not use any of Google's services, which is very, very difficult to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you also have the problem where, I mean, end users generate a lot of revenue for Google. Like, did you see the story that says that, you know, what people are paying for Google services? It's like, if you're a user of Google and Gmail and you go to YouTube occasionally and you use G+ and whatever, you use Google Docs, you are essentially paying about $5,000 for the privilege. Like, even though it's free, like, that's the money that they're making off of you.
Right.
So, like,
yeah. I mean, but that's how advertising and, you know, quote unquote free content and services works. You know, it's like, yes, there is a price, but you don't have to pay it up front.
Yeah. But I always resent that, and yes, but do I think that they're giving me $5,000 worth of service? I don't know. Like, I really don't know.
Right.
And part of that is that, you know, first of all, it's not an easy task to get a hold of anybody there about anything. If you are an end user and you have a problem with, like, Gmail, like, you know, you're posting messages on a website is what you're going to do.
Well,
you may or may not. And
there are so many users, and there are so many that it, you know, it's a massive company. It's not like, yeah, it's not like you can talk one on one with someone right now. Yeah.
And the people that are there also have a huge attitude problem when you do get somebody, because the perception in higher ed, at least, seems to be, I mean, there's a lot of educational institutions that have gone to Google Apps for Education, and the people that have, everyone that I've talked to is generally happy with it. The problem is that part of that process, Google does not get really hands-on about any of it, and they don't make themselves really available to discuss any concerns or issues that you have. They have kind of a, well, you know, you can do whatever you want, but we're Google and you'll be back attitude about everything. Whereas,
which is very different from the traditional way of selling enterprise services, which is like, we'll support you all the time. You know, we will support everything.
If you so much as, like, you know, click on the contact link for Office Live 365, you will get someone from Microsoft flying out, like, that afternoon to knock on your door to talk to you about the form that you almost filled out. You know, like, they are very high touch, and they really want to do business, and they are willing to discuss things about their business and their operations that Google does not. So, for example, some of the concerns that you might have if you are somebody that has to deal with confidential or privileged data is, where does that data get stored at rest? And what data centers are they in the United States, or does it ever move? And, like, how is custody handled and things like that? And how do you handle requests for information? And if you're a public institution, you have to comply with open records requests, and how are those going to be fulfilled? It's very hard to get anybody at Google that will talk to you about any of that.
Right.
Whereas, again, it's, you know, on the Microsoft side, you've got Microsoft falling all over themselves. And while Google gives a lot of things away for free, Microsoft does too. People give them a lot of crap for, like, you know, pricing and things are expensive and whatever. But if you are stuck on price on a Microsoft product, you can probably get them to give it to you for free. Or very, very close to it. I mean, I'm just saying that that's kind of an issue. And so, you know, do I feel like the services that I use Google for, I'm being provided with the service that I'm paying, essentially, since they're making that much off me? I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
I'm a little worried about that.
Well,
it's like Facebook. I resent the fact that when every time I log into Facebook, I'm essentially working for Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I don't have a Facebook account. Yeah,
I know you're really cool. You're too above that.
But
I'm starting to get the same way about Google now. Like, where I'm like, I'm starting to resent the fact that, like, they are mining me that extensively across all their properties, so that I can help them, like, sell crap to people because people want to be able to buy the ads.
Right. Yeah. Well, we've talked about this on previous shows, and I think the end result is, like, you would like to get something valuable out of that. In a sense, you are. Like, I mean, the fact that you can use Google Search is a valuable thing.
Yes.
But, like, when that value proposition is no longer, you know, is no longer in your favor, which it sounds like for you, maybe, you know, it's getting to that point.
I'm rapidly approaching that point.
Right. Yeah. Then it becomes a question. Then this new privacy policy unification becomes an issue, because like maybe that value proposition is there for, you know, Google Docs or for a single service. But when you're talking about the whole network, maybe the value proposition is not in your favor. So
that's where it starts to get dicey. So this has been a really interesting week for me, because I'm kind of chewing on that already anyways, and now it's even more prevalent and more front of mind. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so the new policies don't take effect until March 1st, but definitely will be interesting to watch. And
I mean, the iPhone thing's not, or the Android thing's not a big deal, because I don't think I'll ever have an Android device. Like, I mean, I don't have any reason to. And it's like,
right,
you know, I wanted to switch to Ting, but I can't switch to Ting until they get an iPhone, because I'm not going to pay that much for software all over again. You know, like, it's a cost convenience thing, just like with Google. Yeah. I mean, you're always doing that.
Yep. Yep. All right. But interesting news nonetheless, and definitely something we will keep an eye on as it progresses. So, all right. Yeah. We talked about earlier in the show your issues with premium text charges.
Yeah, I found out some good news about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can, as a consumer, you can call your mobile operator. And here's the thing. Like, these premium text messages, there's a couple of things that they exist for, from what I can put together. And I'm going to exaggerate a little bit. So the first one is so that, you know, in the days before civilization, when you wanted to buy a ringtone or some other like stupid thing for your phone, you would end up at your mobile operator's captive portal on their WAP browser, and you would, you know, pick a ringtone or something, and then they would deliver it.
And that would happen on its own sometimes. You wouldn't even necessarily want to buy a ringtone.
Like, you don't want to get the messages today. Yes. That still happened before. But what happened was, is then they would send you this message, and it's like a way for them to get paid, because they could send you this premium message, and then they would have like the payload for your ringtone included in this or what have you. So essentially, they'd use it as a way to sell stuff. Mm-hmm. These days, we have Fire and the Wheel and the App Store and the Android market and the BlackBerry, whatever the hell, whatever they call their thing, the BlackBerry Bazaar.
They swear they have apps. They swear.
There's like 15 guys and two tumbleweeds, and it's like going to a storage auction.
Oh, man.
Yeah. You're looking for treasure in Cletus's pickup. At the Android or at the BlackBerry store. But, you know, now you have better ways to buy better stuff, but they still have these stupid messages. And if you call your mobile operator, you can tell them to block just premium messages. And now what they'll actually do is the messages themselves may or may not continue to get delivered, but they will block from being charged to your account. So even when some D-bag in Boston signs you up for a bunch of stupid services, even if you get the message, he's not getting his $9.99, which could not make me happier.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can call your operator. You might have to like be a little persistent about it, because I got a, how do I say this? Not someone from our land the first time I tried to do this. And they proceeded to like try to, you know, oh, well, okay, we'll go ahead and remove the text messaging plan from your account. And I'm like, no, no, I don't want to do that. And it was basically like just misunderstanding on what exactly I was asking for. But I wanted them to remove premium text message charges from my account, and like from all the lines on my, well, I shouldn't say all, I had two lines.
And really, and what are you going to use those for? I mean,
like, nothing, nothing. The only thing they're there for is for people to con you.
Yeah,
in my opinion, you are a fool if you let them stay on.
Charity donations have recently moved
but
to
I
that
can,
model. Sometimes, you know, I think the Haiti effort was famously notable for that. But still, like apparently those things are a bad deal on the charities side. Like there are huge fees involved in them soliciting donations via text message. So even is not a good idea. Yeah.
It's huge. So not only are we saving you from malicious ass bags in Boston, we are also saving you from yourself and your generosity.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you want to donate to a charity, you should do it through their website, or, you know, send them a check or something. I mean, you know, a text message, all of that money is not getting to that charity, basically.
So. Yeah. Well, and then there's also the argument that, you know, in any charity, there's all the operations costs and the overhead and all that. And you know, if you remove premium text messaging, you also probably will not be able to vote for your American Idol, which is also important to note.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But, you know, it's just if you do not care about things like that, and I have a really hard time believing that it's really going to be a critical issue, but it will definitely save you heartache in the future to get the feature blocked. Because if I had not known to be vigilant and go after this and look for it, I probably would not have even noticed that I was going to be paying an extra $40.
Yeah.
I mean, like my cell phone bill is already like $150.
Yeah, yeah. It's easy to get lost in it.
$9 here and there doesn't really show up.
Yep.
Unless I go digging. So I was glad to do that.
Yeah. All right. And then real quick before we get to the storage wars, which I'm looking forward to, you had a blog post recently about this story about judges ordering people to decrypt laptops. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, it happens periodically. Like there's been three or four cases in particular that have been pretty interesting about this, where someone has data on a laptop or device that's been encrypted, and the judge or the prosecution or the police try to get the person to do one of two things, either give up the passwords or give up the data. And each case is different. There hasn't been like a really clear, and again, this comes back to the I'm not an attorney thing. So it's not something that I have a great deal of expertise in, but my initial reaction when reading the story was like, you know, this is total BS. Like,
people aren't supposed to be compelled to testify against themselves.
Yeah.
So decrypting a laptop with potentially incriminating information on it seems a little iffy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and a lot of people feel really strongly that it is absolutely self-incrimination.
Right.
But in the particular example of this case, which is like it's a mortgage fraud case, the issue is, first of all, they already have in evidence that the information that corroborates the prosecution's theory is on this laptop because the defendant has said as much.
Right.
And also has kind of like this neener, neener, na na attitude about the whole thing. But like in conversations with other people has like essentially admitted that, yeah, like if they get access to it, then they definitely have them dead to rights. But, but this, or, you know, the implication is there. They don't necessarily directly spell it out. But the real issue and the differentiating factor here seems to be that courts have ruled historically, as recently as last year, or 2 years ago, because in 2010 there was a case where this was important. But revealing a password is testifying against yourself.
Okay, yeah.
But if you are given a lawful order, or are, you know, asked to comply with a search warrant request for the data in an unencrypted format, you are obligated to deliver it.
Uh-huh.
It's just like if, you know, Arthur Anderson or some accounting firm or somebody that's like being raided by the feds, and they show up and they're like, yeah, we need to see all your documents for X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, there's like three people in the back that are like running through a shredder. You know, that's illegal. Like,
right. Yeah.
It's illegal to not, it's against the law to not comply with an order like that. And you can be charged, you know, it's either, you know, contempt of court or obstruction of justice interference or any number of things that you can be charged with for doing that. So similarly, in this case, by not handing over the data, you're kind of hosing yourself and committing another crime. So for me, it's something that has not been challenged a lot. And the cases previous to this one have been too bad to get too close to, because they're usually people that have either been charged with receiving or trafficking in child pornography.
Hmm. Okay.
And so some dude is being charged with this crime and doesn't want to turn over encrypted data because there's case history that in a particular case where someone had been charged with receiving and trafficking in child pornography, did not have to give his password to a grand jury, and it was specifically because they asked for the password.
There's a difference between asking for the password and asking for the data. I guess.
Yes, and you have to be, and you know, like the order or the search warrant needs to be somewhat specific enough to get you in the vicinity of what you're going to be getting.
Right.
Because otherwise, you have like this notion or this issue in law that if you find something that you're not looking for, you may or may not be able to use that in the course of your prosecution, or you might have to have it be. In this particular case, it would have had to have been in the investigation and possible prosecution of a different crime.
Huh.
So there's a whole lot of issues involved. And my initial reaction being, you know, being very upset and like, you know, self-righteously, you know, indignant about this, like, rah, 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 that while I was reading some of the particulars about this case and like what actually was being said and being done, I wound up agreeing with Judge Blackburn's decision to order the lady to hand over the data. I don't know what she's going to end up doing or what's going to happen next. But I mean, I did some quick math, and there was a guy that did like, you know, somewhere between a few million to $3 billion in mortgage fraud, and he only got 40 months. And dudes that like, you know, steal $100 go to jail for, you know, 10 years or 5 years. So there's this whole discrepancy there. But, you know, you can be in prison, as far as I know, obstruction of justice for up to 20 years. So if a judge wants to be a real dick, they can be like, okay, well, if you don't give over the data, we'll just stick you in the can for, you know, 5-10 years. And then that'll be that.
All right. Well, I mean, so you have a blog post up on this where you sort of work through your whole thought process on both sides of this argument, because you did kind of pivot at some point. So,
well, yeah, I mean, like I definitely it's kind of me thinking out loud, and it's a different thing that I've really written something like that before. And it's, you know, it's not too political. It's not too legal, obviously, because I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So it's more along the lines of making the distinction between asking for data and asking for a password seems to be kind of really where it all hinges.
Cool. All right. And in the few remaining minutes of this show, probably the most important topic we will talk about all year.
Ever.
It is the TV show Storage Wars on A&E. So did you just, like, over your sick period become familiar with this show?
Yep.
Is that how this happened?
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I was watching, I'd seen, when you first mentioned it to me a couple weeks ago, I did check it out, and okay, I was like, oh, pretty good.
Yeah.
And then I watched a lot of it while I was sick.
It's easy to watch a lot of it for two reasons. One, A&E shows it constantly. I mean, like, A&E is, I have in the show notes, it's the only show A&E airs in the evening at this, like, it's just,
it's like their new Law and Order.
It's Storage Wars from like 4 p.m. until 2 a.m. I mean, like,
so do you have, like, the 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Law and Order block.
Yeah.
On A&E.
Exactly. Exactly. And then not only that, but they produce so many episodes of it too, because it must be super cheap to make. I mean, it's got to be. And so
I mean, all reality shows are pretty cheap like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is. I mean, there are basically four main characters that they follow. They're always in the same place.
Well, there's also spin-offs, though, because they have like Storage Wars Texas.
Oh, Storage Wars Texas, because everything's bigger in Texas.
Yeah. You're not lying.
Yeah, yeah, no, including the people on that show. So the basic premise of this show, if you haven't heard of it already, which I would be surprised if you haven't, it's actually been kind of making the rounds lately. There's these storage lockers where the owner of the storage locker stops paying the rent.
Yeah, it's like any you know, you drive past them all the time.
Yeah, yeah, and then the owner stops paying rent. Then the storage locker itself, at least this is the rule in California and presumably Texas as well. The storage
service contract too.
Yeah, yeah, and the storage locker itself goes up for auction, and all these you know, potential buyers walk through. They open up the storage locker. They get to look inside. They don't get to go inside or really, you know, turn over anything in their hands or anything like that. They just get to look at it, and so they look at it. They all walk by and look at the locker. And then they have an auction right there, and they all bid up the locker price, and one of them gets the locker, and then they get to dig through it and see what they discovered.
So there's a lot of people, we'll call them the great unwashed.
Yeah.
That show up in with stars in their eyes and desires of being incredibly wealthy by finding a genie in a lamp.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you have like, you know, the four heroes of the show who are actually doing that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so the show follows four characters. One of them is actually a couple. So a couple and then three characters.
I think like two of them own like consignment shops, right?
Yep.
And then
yeah.
one's like just a general collector and someone that just
and
I
then
what
one is like a has like a distribution something.
That's right.
Something. Yeah. So but they all, you know, typically one of them is just basically buying stuff for himself, I guess, for the most part. But the other three are kind of buying things to resell them. And they dig through these lockers and it's so arbitrary. It's like they'll be looking through the stuff and be like, "Yeah, this table could be $150 in my shop." Yeah. Oh, there's a $40 bill right there. So they dug up like a
They do a lot of self-appraisal pretty quick on that show.
Yeah, exactly. And then
they get a lot of things that they don't... Yeah.
And there's this little counter in the bottom corner that's, like, you know, ringing up.
Ching,
like,
ching,
man,
ching.
Oh, man, wow, they made a lot of money on that. And, like, it's like,
and then, like...
You don't actually make the money until you sell it. Like,
yeah. Well, you know. But they do... I mean, they do also take you out of the storage locker area and then, you know, meet with appraisers art auction people and do...
So
like
you were saying it's like it's part antique roadshow.
Yes, yeah. There's an antiques roadshow component to this program that cannot be beat.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Like this, and then Pawn Stars on History Channel are two shows that discovered now that, like, hey, you know that antique roadshow thing? Like, people really like that. You know?
Yeah, people like seeing that like old crap they've got in their garage could buy them a new boat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because people like to justify the fact that they have all this old crap around.
So Roger that.
Yeah, so they like watching this type of show.
Yeah, there's been some pretty cool stuff on there, like a Revolutionary War era like musket.
Uh huh. Yep. Yeah.
That one,
yeah.
And then the movie memorabilia shows up. Sometimes artwork. I mean, a lot of it's like prints or replications or forgeries. Like we saw some forged coins on that show once.
Oh, I didn't see that. Huh.
Yeah, they're fake coins.
I was telling you before the show about the NES.
Tell me.
This was the worst.
I didn't see that.
This was just absolutely the worst. So they have this guy. This like they tried to paint him as like the nemesis. It was he's Mark Vallejo, and so Vallejo comes in, and Vallejo's like the real high roller, right? And he's bidding up every locker, and it's like no one can compete with Vallejo because Vallejo just bids up and bids up and bids up and just doesn't care. So they painted this guy as the nemesis. And this guy comes in, and he buys this locker, and he's digging through this locker, and he's got this really thick accent. It's like,
these guys get really mean sometimes, too. Like, they've almost, like...
Oh, man.
I've seen people, like, you know,
oh,
throw
there
punches.
Is drama. There yeah. is definite drama. So, you know, Vallejo's, like, this evil guy, and he's looking through this locker. And he's digging through, and he finds this trash bag. And he's digging through this trash bag, and he's like, oh... This is what we look for in an auction. You know, this is it. This is what, you know, this is what we do this for. And then, of course, like all good moments like that, they cut to commercial immediately, right?
Yeah, and then when they come back, they show you again the last 2 minutes that you just watched.
Yeah. So then they come back, and it's like, oh, this is what we look for. This is why we do storage auctions. And then he pulls this thing out, and it's like the grodiest, most awful condition, just covered in crust and junk. NES console you've ever seen. It's just terror. It's like yellowing. It's got like brown spots on it. It's awful. And
maybe some bodily fluids.
Yeah. And he's like, please let this be an NES 001. And you can find this clip on YouTube. I recommend you search for it.
Okay,
and he flips it over and he's like, it is. It's an NES 001. And, you know, it's like bottom arm at the bottom. It's like, this is one of these went up for auction for $10,000 online recently.
Uh-huh.
So,
all right.
So then him and this the one of the other characters, Daryl, they go to an appraiser, which is just like a local game store. And they walk in this game store, and he's got this NES. And he's like, what is this worth? I found this. I saw online $10,000. And the clerk at the game store is just like, what?
I got to get my manager.
No, I mean, it was clear. It was like the guy. It was a small, you know, community game store. Yeah. So it was like, it wasn't a GameStop or anything. And this guy's like, well, I don't know where that came from, but, you know.
I'll give you 5 cents.
These things are only really worth money if they work. And so he plugs it into a screen, and of course, completely dead. and then he's like, oh, no, well, it doesn't. I'm sorry to tell you, it doesn't work at all. And this Baleo guy's like, oh, well, ma'am, how much is it worth then? And the clerk's like, maybe $10.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Oh, it's the best. And it's like, you know, this online auction was a real thing, and there was a super rare game. I think
it was the Zelda Gold Edition, right?
No. This was Stadium Events, I think it was. Oh. It was super rare game, and the game itself was worth the $10,000, and the rest of the stuff in the bundle, including the NES, was worthless. You know, and NES 001 just means NES. I mean, there weren't any other. I mean, there may have been some, but that was the really popular NES model,
like that
number
bundle.
Yeah. So,
but there was like a at some like game like what was it? It was like some gaming conference or like a competition or something where some people that attended got like a special edition Legend of Zelda. And yeah, those are supposed to be super rare, and people pay tons of dough for those.
Oh, man. If you ever want to spend a few hours reading some interesting stories, look up like the most valuable NES games. It's crazy because there's some things that are like there's one made internally at, I think, like Coca-Cola or Pepsi or something. There's just, you know, and there's like five copies out there. You know, stuff gets crazy, but clearly.
Hang on, I got some dust in mine. Hold on. Yeah, yep. There we go. That's better.
Anyway, but clearly.
Did they try that at the store when it didn't work? Did he try tapping on it and blowing into it?
No, I remember those days. You mean, did Mark Vallejo try that? No, clearly Mark Vallejo knows very little about the NES.
Yeah. I'm shocked.
Yeah. Yeah. That among the many great moments of Storage Wars.
God, that's such a good show.
It's the worst best show on TV. It's oh man, what a show. What a show.
It's good. I love it.
Anyway, that will do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. Ran a little bit over on time, but it's worth it to talk about Storage Wars. Such good stuff. If you want to contact us, the email address is show@hellyeah.com. We are on the World Wide Web at show.hellyeah.com.
And on the Twitter machine, twitter.com/hellyeahshow, or send a tweet to @hellyeahshow.
All right. And that will do it. We will see you next week.
Yep.